When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
Welcome to another podcast. It's LiesOffice.com, brought to you by Madison Firefighters Local 311, Madison Teachers Incorporated, and Madison Teamsters Local 695. All right, joining us now, John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation. Brother, it's been a while since we've talked, but since we talked, the city in which I was born got the Democratic Convention for 2020 for the first time in the history of the country. Let me play this. This is from WISC-TV.
Former Republican Governor Scott Walker is celebrating the news that the Democratic National Convention is coming to Milwaukee. He championed the deal that brought Pfizer Forum to Milwaukee.
That makes me proud that for any commission, whether it was the RNC or the DNC, something that big is going to be held in something that we played a part in.
Walker and fellow Republicans agree the convention will give the city an economic boost.
I think it's super for Milwaukee. It's super for the state. You know, their money is not red money. It's not blue money. It's green money.
GOP strategists say they believe the convention will highlight the contrast between their party and the Democrats in a city with a, quote, socialist history.
It's also an opportunity to show the people of Wisconsin a front row seat, just how far left the Democrat Party on a national level has gone.
Meanwhile, Democratic Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes told reporters the DNC will provide a huge opportunity for his hometown.
This is absolutely the right call for so many reasons. As we know, every presidential election goes through the state of Wisconsin, and it'd be a great place for us to pick our nominee.
It is so wonderful.
While national Democratic leaders from Wisconsin, U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin and Congressman Mark Pocan are acknowledging how great the convention will be for their party.
It's significant that they've looked at Wisconsin and they're looking at the upper Midwest as pivotal to the 2020 elections.
Pocan joked that this means the 2020 Democratic presidential candidate will have to come to Wisconsin now.
I think it's going to really send the message that we need to send looking at 2020.
Well, nice little shot at Hillary.
Donald.
Although some say she would have lost Wisconsin by more than 22,000 had she come. All right, so
fairness.
Scott Walker.
One stop.
Scott Walker.
Stop in Eau Claire would have done the job.
Now, I was with Scott Walker at the groundbreaking, among many other people, and you know, I remember saying to him today, "This is a nice bipartisan deal. It's a, you know, this is a step forward. This is very different than the Miller Park deal," and he agreed. But why is he so public right now? What is the point of him taking a lap in this moment?
Yeah, it was odd. It's sort of like they found him first or something.
Right.
You know, it's an odd dynamic. Why wouldn't you have Tony Evers as like the first person that you would talk
right.
to? And the only reason is not to pick on this particular outlet or whatever, but the
Oh, it wasn't just this outlet.
Yeah. The reason you would do that is because do you think the DNC would have come to Milwaukee if Scott Walker was governor?
Still? Probably not.
And you see, that's the subtlety of it. Yes, this stadium, and can Scott Walker take a bit of a victory lap there and say, yeah, I supported that thing when, frankly, some Republicans might not have? Yeah, that's fine.
It was the truth is, his very able chief of staff, Eric Shute, did all the negotiating.
We understand. That was during Shute's, year-long service.
Right. Well, second time around. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
But the important thing to understand is that if you look at the dynamics of this, the reason this convention is coming to Milwaukee is because Wisconsin sent the most powerful signal of the 2018 midterm elections. Wisconsin State, Scott Walker, and Republicans that essentially swept in 2010 and 2014. Come 2018, Democrats win every statewide race in Wisconsin. So, you know, that's the heart of this thing. Essentially, the Democratic Party has chosen Milwaukee for a variety of reasons. Number one, I think it's the best city possible to do a convention in. I'm 100%er for Milwaukee. But beyond that, if you look at the political calculus, choices had to be made. And so are you going to try for some new strategy for how you get to 270 electoral votes, i.e., do you go to Texas? Do you go to Florida?
Yeah, if Beto had won, Texas might have had an even better chance, right?
They would have gone there,
right?
Sure. If Andrew Gillum had won Florida, there's a chance that you would have gone that route.
Although Florida's strategy at the end, when they realized they were probably going to lose this thing, by saying Milwaukee wasn't fancy enough and Miami's a better place for rich people, that was the dumbest strategy ever.
The worst. Yeah, the worst. And so, but the bottom line is that there are political calculations in this. What happened in 2018, this is not complicated. What happened in 2018 was, as regards convention siting, was that a group of states, Michigan, Wisconsin, arguably Ohio with Sherrod Brown, although not up and down the ticket, Pennsylvania, states that had gone to Trump, sent a signal that they are prepared to come back into the Democratic fold. Democrats then looked across that map and said, well, where's a place where symbolically and practically you can put a convention? And Milwaukee was perfect.
Now, this could be a tale of two very different conventions, depending on who the nominee is. If Bernie Sanders is the nominee, and that is a growing possibility.
Real possibility.
A real possibility. Will that diffuse some of the protests that would normally take place at a convention? Or if it's a more conventional candidate, a corporatist like Amy Klobuchar or Joe Biden, although Joe Biden doesn't really wear the corporatist suit on the outside.
It'd be plenty of labor.
Right. So is this a tale of two different possibilities?
Well, I think here's the bottom line let's say that Sanders is nominated, right? Our Republican friends will point out that, you know, Milwaukee is a city that had socialist mayors. Now you're nominating a socialist for president, right? And in fact, yes, and I don't think you'd have as many protests per se, because frankly, a lot of people who would tend to protest the Democratic Party wouldn't necessarily be socialists, but they'd be on the left and they'd be concerned on issues of race.
We all remember what happened in Los Angeles in 2000.
Yeah.
Where there was an alternative convention.
Uh-huh. I was at it.
And I got stuck in the riot.
Well, I was at the riot.
I was.
But you didn't.
I backed right into a lowrider and had a police officer right on top of me. Then I got lost in that neighborhood just south of the Staples Center. Let me tell you something. I was a little bit like a fish out of water.
Well, in Milwaukee, you're not going to get lost.
No, it's my hometown. I've already got my hotel room, John. I'm ready.
I know you're ready. Let me finish one thought here in this that I think is a subtlety of the choice of Milwaukee. The Milwaukee is a city that has challenges, and it hasn't solved all its problems by any measure. But Milwaukee is a great American city. A part of its history as a great American city is that it did, in fact, in the 20th century, have three socialist mayors. Our Republican friends will, of course, attack that and say, oh, you know, it's proving some socialist thing. In fact, I would suggest to you, if Bernie Sanders were to be nominated, certainly not a certainty, but if that were to happen, I suspect he would address the legacy in Milwaukee. Because remember, when Milwaukee had socialist mayors, it was rated the most fiscally responsible, best run, and healthiest city in America.
I believe the quote from John Goethe is, it was called the best run city in America.
That's right. And in fact, it was so healthy. They did such a great job with public health at a time when a lot of cities struggled with it. This is under Mayor Dan Hoan, who was really, you know, the longest serving and also remarkably capable mayor. It was so healthy. They retired one of the awards for healthiest city. They didn't let Milwaukee compete anymore because it wasn't fair to everybody else. You know, Milwaukee was so much ahead of the curve.
Do these Republicans understand that there was functioning capitalism during this time period? The city of Milwaukee wasn't running all the businesses?
Well, let me offer this. No. Do you understand? It was when Milwaukee boomed, when the industries started. Really,
right.
They were expanding, and Milwaukee was a larger city, very, very physically healthy, economically healthy, and socially healthy. It was a city that was trying to function, to be fair and fairer and more decent. And
So now, did Carl Zeidler beat Hone, right?
In 1940. Yeah.
Right. Zeidler then went and fought in World War II and died.
That's right.
And he was a Democrat, but he was probably pretty progressive, too, right? He wasn't a...
Pretty progressive. Right, he was more backed by the business, downtown business community. Hone, you know, Hone really was a leftist.
Uh-huh.
And there were, you know, there were push and pull. And one of the things that Hone did in the 30s that did cause consternation, I don't know if you know about this, is one of the great stories of Dan Hone. That they were having a real problem with affordability of food, right? So he took vacant city buildings, found farmers who were having a hard time selling their products or getting their products to market, and he arranged a deal where the farmers would come in, bring their food in, and sell it at very fair, very low prices in neighborhoods that didn't have, you know, affordable food. Now, if you can imagine, the grocery stores didn't
like that so much.
Yeah. Now, and so there was always a push and pull. We should never deny the political challenges there. But the interesting thing is that of course, after Carl Zeidler got elected in 1940, the only break, by the way, the only break in socialist rule of Milwaukee from 1916 to 1960, the Carl Zeidler period there, Frank Zeidler got elected. And Frank served the last 12 years of that period from 1948 to 1960 as a proud socialist mayor. During the McCarthy era,
one of the main city buildings is named after him.
Well, and there's a bridge named after Hone.
Right.
You know. So anyway, bottom line is we don't have to belabor all this history now. It will be belabored. It will be considered. But what the point I want to make is that if our good Republican friends want to bring up the fact that Milwaukee was a socialist city, and that, in fact, say, if Bernie Sanders is nominated or somebody else is nominated, and they just want to, you know, do the Trump thing and call everybody a socialist, instead of running from it and saying that's an insult or that's a negative thing, if Democrats are smart, they will say, well, maybe we're not a socialist party. We don't necessarily agree with all this. But it's important to understand that when, you know, Emil Seidel, Dan Hone, and Frank Zeidler were mayors of Milwaukee, Milwaukee was standing out nationally as a city that was stunningly well-run and that was financially more responsible than other cities. People need to understand, you know, Dan Hone didn't believe in taking loans. He didn't believe in running up debt. And so Milwaukee was actually a pay-go, to some extent, not in every area, but a city that you know, balanced its books during the Depression. So, I mean, there's a great story to tell there. It's frankly
right.
It's a story that I wish.
And I hope another story that
responsible.
I hope another story that will be told, because now the Fiserv Forum's address, rather than 4th Street, is Vell Phillips Boulevard.
Beautiful. And, of course, Milwaukee, not a great, you know, Milwaukee's got a history on race that is very challenging and continues to, you know, have pushes and pulls. And we should not, no one should deny that. At the same time, Milwaukee was a city where you had African Americans at a reasonably early stage rise to political positions of prominence. And, you know, obviously the great pioneer was Vell Phillips, who, amazingly enough, lived such a long life that we all had a chance to know her. And frankly, know her so well that sometimes it was only late in her life that people realized what an epic figure she was. But it's wonderful. And you know, the thing that's really great is Vell Phillips' friend, Gwen Moore, will, in fact, you know, who's going to be more central to this convention than Gwen Moore?
Right.
You know, it's going to be wonderful. It's a really cool thing.
This was quite a good moment for Mayor Barrett.
Yes, really good for Mayor Barrett, and who, frankly, has stewarded the city in an awful lot of great ways. Very good moment, frankly, again, I would argue, for Mandela Barnes, who was quoted in some of those reports, because here you have a young man from the city, from, you know, one of the toughest neighborhoods in the city, who is now the number two official in the state. So, you know, you have a way of really celebrating people who aren't just of Milwaukee, aren't just from Milwaukee, but are really proud of Milwaukee, that love their city, that recognize its challenges, but that also recognize, you know, this is a great place that's ready to host a national convention.
Well, it is interesting. The Milwaukee Bucks did the right thing when building the arena, part of the agreement negotiated in part by our friend Peter Rickman, was to make sure that the workers in the Fiserv Forum had the ability to organize and get paid a living wage.
And if that had not been done, Sly, that would be an immediate complex issue for this convention.
Well, there wouldn't have been a Fiserv Forum because it was a bipartisan vote because of that. We would have an aging Bradley Center with a basketball team that left town, and we wouldn't have gotten the convention.
It wouldn't have happened. But they've had just one final element there, right? That would be all those things true, as you say. But this would be an ongoing issue, right? People would be saying, "Oh, the hypocrisy of the Democrats," right? They're going to a place that, you know, doesn't pay workers well, that doesn't do these things. And so this is one of the lessons that's important to understand. When you do the right thing for workers, you actually do good for business, good for you know, the economic.
That's right. And one of the things that hurt Houston was a labor strike.
Well, and you know, frankly, you're talking about an opportunity of a couple of right-to-work states in the running for this, right? Versus a state that now, Wisconsin, is a right-to-work state, tragically. But you have, again, this is why I would emphasize Governor Evers, you have a governor who in his budget address or budget program says he wants to overturn right to work.
All right, we'll take a break there. John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation at SlysOffice.com.
Similar to a well-tuned automobile, a guitar requires the same level of attention to perform at its very best. No matter how expensive your guitar may be, we will treat you and your instrument with the utmost respect. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson. We love guitars.
Welcome back to SlysOffice.com, brought to you by our friends at Madison Computer Works and Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson. All right, so let's talk a little bit about what's going on. Speaker Pelosi made news this week when she said this.
Do I agree with her? Yes, I do.
Democratic leaders fell in line with Speaker Pelosi today.
And impeachment is not perfect.
One day after she said this.
I just don't believe in it. They wanted me to impeach President Bush for the Iraq War. I didn't believe in it then. I don't believe in it now. It divides the country.
But not everyone got the memo.
If he's that bad and if he's that unfit, then we ought to do something about it now.
Some progressives argue the president's hush money payments to porn star Stormy Daniels meet the definition of high crimes and misdemeanors.
So you want to keep the option of impeachment on the table?
It's always an option for any president, any administration, and we're going to do our investigation.
President Trump has always brushed off the notion.
I think it's very hard to impeach somebody who's done a great job.
And today, Republicans played up the split between Pelosi and some of her members.
I think she's dealing with reality, which is she's not in control of her caucus.
Even Pelosi's Senate counterpart said he wants to keep his options open.
We have to see what the Mueller report says, I think, before making any conclusion.
Moderate Democrats worry that too much talk of impeachment won't sit well in their swing districts. Plus, they note that without Republican buy-in, and there isn't any right now, any impeachment vote is doomed to fail in the Senate. Jeff?
Nancy?
All right, your thoughts.
House Speaker Carl Albert announced that impeachment was off the table. Richard Nixon. He's not worth it, said Albert.
That never happened. That never happened,
oh,
John.
Sorry, my mistake. Carl Albert, who was very conservative Democrat, actually at least very moderate Democrat, and others said, no, we have to forward these issues to the proper committees and go where we have to go. They put key people into the right positions. Richard Nixon was faced with the threat of impeachment. The House Judiciary Committee voted 3 articles of impeachment in an election year, I might add. And Richard Nixon, you know, looking at that real prospect, with Republicans in the Senate telling him that they couldn't support him, stood down and left the presidency. And the Democrats were, of course, horribly punished for that. They won landslide victories for the House and the Senate in that year, and 2 years later took the presidency. Speaker Pelosi is wrong. She is wrong on the history, wrong on the sentiments, and frankly, most wrong on the moral and constitutional issues that are involved.
Well, I will not quibble with those two things. Let me ask this, though. The Democrats have controlled both branches of government in the mid-70s, right? 1974, they controlled the Senate. We kind of lived in a different reality in some respects, in that on both sides of the aisle, there were people that were legitimately there to uphold the law and Article 1 of the Constitution. We now have essentially a cult on one side, and people that are probably a little more timid on the other.
But I accept everything you just said. Wouldn't putting impeachment forward for real reasons, literally parallel reasons to that which you held Nixon to account, for the exact reasons that the founders said that you should have the ability to, you know, check and balance a quote-unquote elected despot or king for 4 years, wouldn't doing that do a better job of exposing the cult than anything else?
Well,
and you say, oh, well, that'll rally the base. I mean, Trump knows how to rally his base. He doesn't need impeachment. If he doesn't have impeachment, do you know what impeachment would do? It would maybe get him off picking on immigrants for a couple days. I'm not kidding. I mean, how in any way does holding Donald Trump to account for his high crimes and misdemeanors, doing everything he can to do so, how in any way does that help him or the Republicans in the Senate? Anybody who thinks it does really hasn't been paying attention.
He really does put Andrew Johnson to shame.
Look, well, look, in fairness, Andrew Johnson was very bad. But, you know, Trump's in the running there. And, you know, he makes Nixon look like, you know, just a dream come true. And so what we're looking at here is a serious problem. And this is one in which I've actually defended Pelosi a lot over, you know, since the election, how she came in, because I think she's actually done some things quite well. But on this one, there is no question of what she is doing. She is placing the 2020 electoral prospects ahead of the duty she swore an oath to uphold. Is she the first elected official, first speaker to do that? Absolutely not. In fact, that's common. And so she's not like some, you know, unique sinner in this regard. But this is where the problem comes in on two levels. Number one, it comes in because I think an awfully lot of Americans recognize that there should be a higher constitutional duty, that a duty of the Constitution should actually involve holding presidents to account when they do wrong. And two, she's really wrong, starkly wrong, on the politics of it. I've written histories of impeachment. The fact of the matter is, moving an impeachment proposal, you know, taking it as far as it can logically go, it may not go even to articles of impeachment, it may just simply be raised. It does two things. It usually holds the president, you know, within limits. It actually has some good impact. And it doesn't harm the party that does it. You know, everybody's like, oh, trying to impeach Clinton back in 98, that destroyed the Republicans. Where were the Republicans in 2000? Moving into the White House, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the one of the great lost impeachment attempts historically didn't become fully realized was when Truman took over the steel plants, or, you know, tried to do so back in the early 50s, a number of Republicans raised the prospect of impeachment. It was on the front page of the New York Times. It was discussed on national radio programs. The courts ultimately intervened, but these Republicans were running around talking about impeachment all over the place. Two things happened. Number one, Truman decided not to seek re-election in 52, which he could have done. Number two, the Republicans swept into the White House and actually had a really, really good year politically. There's just no evidence that doing this stuff does you harm. In fact, there's quite a bit of evidence that it can do you good.
All right, let's talk about the shape of the Democratic race. Obviously, early polls in Iowa have Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders way ahead of everyone else. This is Joe Biden speaking to the firefighters yesterday.
Thank you. I appreciate the energy you showed when I got up here. Save it a little longer. I may need it in a few weeks. Be careful what you wish for. Be careful what you wish for.
All right. Your thoughts about Joe Biden?
I wouldn't be saying be careful what you wish for.
I know it. That's Joe.
Yeah, I know. Always perfectly handled little winking and nodding, you know, with, you know, may need it in a few weeks and stuff like that. But then they'd be careful what you wish for.
It.
But something really bad might happen. But no, look, I've spent a lot of time with firefighters unions in Wisconsin, around the country, and know these people pretty well. And I will tell you something. Joe Biden is super popular with firefighters for reasons that I think a lot of folks may not know. And it goes to why he would be a strong presidential candidate on a lot of levels. There's so much, kind of junior league, decoder ring punditry on the presidential race. And people are like, oh, well, Joe Biden's older and stuff like this. I'm not the biggest fan of Biden, but I will tell you one thing he did for decades in the U.S. Senate and then as vice president, he showed up for unions and for union events and for policy initiatives. And the firefighters have, for decades, had a host of national policy initiatives as regards safety. And Joe Biden has been, going back decades, been a fearsome advocate for that. People know this, and they know that in other unions as well.
He has a better relationship with the police than a lot of other Democrats.
But you're right, and you go across the board, Sly. There's people who, it isn't just, oh, he was a vice president for 8 years. There's folks who've worked with this guy over many, many decades. It doesn't make him perfect. In fact, he's very flawed. But if he runs for president of the United States, he will have, obviously, the power of name recognition. We understand that. He will have the power of the Obama connection, which I think is very powerful, though I don't think Obama will endorse formally. And third, he will have the power of decades of engagement with communities across the country, communities and groups across the country. So, yeah, he would get in as the front runner.
Bernie, Biden. Obviously, Biden took bad votes on trade. Ship jobs out of the country. Senators from Delaware always vote with corporations on these issues.
Horribly.
Because all those corporations license and headquarter in Delaware, technically headquartered.
Banking, right.
So nobody's really ever gone after Joe Biden after those votes and his votes on the bankruptcy bill and that sort of thing. Bernie.
Let's pause for a second and just also say, war in Iraq.
Let's stick to the economic issues because they undercut his blue collar union sort of sensibilities, right?
Yeah.
So if Bernie goes after him on that, does it stick to him, or does it not? And I ask you this for this reason: it seems like every bad vote Hillary ever took or did stuck to her because people didn't really like her.
Yeah.
Even people that don't vote for Joe Biden sort of like him, right? Does it stick to him?
Perhaps, but I think it could stick to him to some extent. And there's some people like really saying, hold it. But maybe there's another subtlety here. You ask if Bernie goes after him, or you suggest that possibly. Mm-hmm. I don't see it happening.
Really?
Do not see that happening. Now, I do see Bernie Sanders saying the Democratic Party, big, underline the whole damn thing, hasn't been where it needs to be on a host of these issues for a very long time, effectively critiquing, broader failures. But here's the problem. What happens if Bernie Sanders goes after Biden, really goes after him, and then Biden really pushes back, and these two 77, 78-year-old guys are arguing away with one another about purity. I happen to be on the Bernie Sanders side of that debate. Who is the happiest person?
Kamala Harris.
Exactly. Or Beto O'Rourke or whoever.
Right.
But I think, you know, or even Elizabeth Warren. It's the bottom line is, if these two guys who both have the vulnerability of folks saying, yeah, you know, they're good, we like them, frankly think they're both capable of being president of the United States, but they're a bit older. If they're, you know, arguing away with each other and they're just like grumbling all the time and, you know, picking at each other, it's like some terrible rivalry between them. Boy, I can't think of anything that would steer voters, you know, toward looking at other candidates. So I don't think Bernie Sanders does it, because I think he's a smart politician.
It is a it is an interesting pool of candidates. Certainly, Beto appears to be getting ready to run.
He's coming to Dubuque.
Yeah.
For St. Patrick's Day.
You gotta love that,
no,
don't you?
No place better than Dubuque. It's a great place for St. Patrick's Day. Totally cool. Yeah.
All right. Finally, your thoughts on Governor Gavin Newsom using his executive power to abolish the death penalty in California.
Effectively abolish, yeah.
Yeah.
That's some complexities with how it all comes together. But I think it's the most important story of the week. And I know nobody else will say that. Here's why I say it. When the state, when the government kills people in our name, right, with our tax dollars, who are incarcerated, who, you know, cannot do anything to say they're not killing people because they pose a threat. They're killing people to punish, right? To my mind, that is just morally wrong. I'm with the Pope on this one. I'm with an awful lot of religious leaders on this one. I just don't think that capital punishment, that execution, in this setting, even for the worst people in the world, is the proper response.
You know, I watched an interview with Gavin Newsom, and we all know that Jerry Brown had some Jesuit training and was raised a Catholic and had that Catholic sensibility on social justice and the death penalty. But Gavin Newsom was raised a Catholic and has some of those same qualities. And I don't think many people know that.
Yeah, and remember, the Catholic Church even itself has been a little complex on some of these issues. So I'm not, you know, I'm not...
No, but I'm just saying
he's really moving on it, and I think it's the proper thing to do. And I would also, I would say, look, we know practically that the death penalty is incredibly costly because of all the, you know, legal issues and everything related to it. We know all the practical arguments against it. But I'm with the majority of the world. The majority of the world, which believes that capital punishment is an archaic medieval response to crimes. It is simply not what you do. And I happen to be a Wisconsinite, and one of our greatest sources of pride is that from pretty much almost the founding of the state, we have barred capital punishment. We in Iowa. And that makes us better places.
And West Virginia.
Better place than story. You know, if you do, that's a baseline reality, and I'm going to stick on that one as far as we go.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation. Thanks for coming to SliesOffice.com.
SliesOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.